Hello everybody, my name is Ron, and this is Ron's Gadget Talk for Wednesday, 27th of July, 2022. In today's episode, we've got a lot to talk about. We've got a couple of phones to talk about, the Samsung's new foldables that are going to be coming out on August 10th, but we have some details about that, and some sort of leaks obviously coming in thick and fast. Along with that, we're going to talk about the OnePlus 10T, which is coming out next week pretty much. So obviously next week's episode, we're going to be talking about the phone in full. Obviously got some details to talk about that also. Plus, we're going to touch upon Anker's new chargers, the gallium nitrate chargers, which apparently are some of the best in class GaN-based chargers out there, along with Eutelsat and OneWeb are merging to take on Starlink. We're going to touch on that at the end, along with obviously Instagram and that controversial UI. It's even gotten the Kardashians talking, and it's gotten the Kardashians mad. It's very rare to obviously the Kardashians to see Kim Kardashian, for example, being like revert back to the old UI. Obviously, she reposted a very well shared post with a petition in the link in the bio in the link of the user's bio. About reverting Instagram back to the kind of the good old days of being sort of a photo sharing app and all. But we're going to touch that later on in the show. But as I said, without further ado, let's get rolling, shall we? First up, these foldables. So the Z Fold 4 and the Z Flip 4 are coming on August 10th. It's kind of nearly confirmed. The teasers are probably showing that. It's about the foldables. Also, Samsung is obviously advertising, you know, like pre-order notifications, so you can sort of sign up and sort of being alerted when the phones go on sale, so you can do that, of course. So they're probably doing their full marketing push for the foldables. They're coming, and I mentioned it in last week's episode that leaks are going to come thick and fast, and we're already getting a whole bunch of new information about these foldables, and I'll probably expect this to continuously flow till the event on August 10th. That's obviously in a fortnight's time in a way, but first in bit of detail. It comes from the ELEC, which is a Korean news site about electronics and all. And we've obviously mentioned them in the past, of course, so they'll probably have some rumor to tell about Samsung's new phones. And their latest rumor is that Samsung is looking to source the batteries for these foldable phones from three different companies. Samsung themselves, their own battery division, which is the SDI division, which makes batteries for all their phones, everything from the A series all the way to the S22 Ultra and beyond. And along with LG and Amperex. And again, this is according to industry sources from the ELEC, so this is a pretty interesting tidbit. Apparently, you'll probably be wondering why they're sourcing from three different companies batteries for these phones. It's more to do with lower components cost, because if three different suppliers come in with equally specced batteries, then the component cost will probably go down. And also, they're trying to source from more places than their own internal divisions, because it would probably help with supply chain, with the current situation with the supply chain that's been disrupted all over the world, and probably obviously in China due to the COVID lockdowns earlier in the year. So they're probably trying to source from as many companies as possible to sort of meet supplies for these foldables. So that's pretty interesting. It's not really news, but again, it's probably to be expected in a way. On top of that, we're already getting more pictures of the Z Flip 4 and the Z Flip 4 primarily. And we got full-on photos from OnLeaks. We obviously shared it to Giznext. So Giznext has obviously an article about the official press renders for the Z Flip 4. I'm probably assuming these are going to be the actual press photos that Samsung will offer when the foldables come out. One thing we can definitely see is that, as I've mentioned in previous last week's episode, where we also seen a leak of these renders, they're not going to be any more different than the Z Flip 3 and Z Fold 3. This one obviously pertains to the Z Flip 4, and obviously it's no more different than the last folding flip phone, which is interesting. But you can probably see, but this is in greater detail, so we can see that the SIM card tray is on the left side, and then the bottom has a USB-C port, and as I mentioned earlier last week, it has a flat frame. It is not a curved frame. It doesn't have a curved frame around the foldable. It's got a flat sort of, it's similar to the S22, but in a flip format. So that's pretty interesting in a way. It's probably good, to say the least. On another one is on the right side of the Z Flip 4, there'll be volume keys, and along with a hotkey, probably that will take you to Google Assistant or Bixby if that's still a thing in 2022. So that's pretty interesting. But more than everything, it kind of looks like an S22 if it's a flip phone in a way, and it has the same sort of dimensions as the Z Flip 3 potentially. So that's interesting in a way. And you're probably wondering what colors now, because if you're looking to buy one. So the Z Flip 4 will come in four different colors: graphite, pink gold, Bora purple, and blue. And interesting about Bora purple, this past week Samsung's released the S22 Ultra in Bora purple, or the S22 pretty much. So that's pretty cool in a way. And it's good to know that Samsung is going to be offering it in four different colorways. And as I said, its design is no more different than the S22s out there, which is again pretty interesting to say the least. Okay, so if you look at the renders on the right side, probably the button, probably the power button, would be a fingerprint sensor. So that's pretty interesting in a way. So yeah, I mean, it's exciting to see that Samsung obviously is going to be bringing a lot to the table, and again in a fortnight's time when we have Unpacked. But yeah, these were kind of sort of the rumors we've gotten for the Z Flip 4, or basically the foldables in question. So again, other than that, really, it's pretty interesting nonetheless. All right, let's switch over to other phones that we're going to talk about. First is the OnePlus 10T. Now, obviously a couple of days after we dropped last week's episode, OnePlus announced that the 10, OnePlus 10T and other sort of gadgets are going to be sh other accessories, let's just say that, are going to be announced at an event that they're doing on August the 3rd, which is obviously next week. So next week's episode, we're going to be obviously men touching upon this in a way. And the launch event's at 10 a.m. Eastern US time, so that's basically 5 o'clock Bahrain time. So probably we'll have to drop an episode of this next week later on, probably a little later on Wednesday. Obviously touch upon the OnePlus 10T. But yeah, they're obviously going to announce the 10T pretty much along with other accessories like new earbuds and all. But it touched upon a couple of things with the OnePlus 10T. First is that they're ditching the alert slider, which has been on every OnePlus phone up until now, including the OnePlus 10 Pro. We didn't obviously talk about that early in the year, but obviously that came out in a way. And the reason that they're ditching the alert slider is apparently it takes up to 30 millimeters to 30 square millimeters of space on the motherboard area of the phone, and also that they wanted to add more bits and bobs, including fast charging, obviously, to the IC chips for that, bigger batteries, and probably and most likely antenna, better antennas, obviously, to offer better 5G performance. It's kind of a silly rationale from OnePlus, again, especially as a brand that doesn't want to settle, and obviously, is focused on offering unique features that make it stand out from, say, a fruit brand or obviously an iconic appliance maker like Samsung, in a way. So that's pretty strange. In a way, but apparently, again, it's to save space to offer bigger batteries and obviously a better antenna system. Obviously, to give you better 5G coverage. I'm probably assuming that the 10T is obviously a lowered spec tier of the OnePlus 10 Pro in a way, so that's not surprising in a way. Another one is the OnePlus 10T is not going to have a Hasselblad branded camera. Now, it's probably to do with the fact that they wanted to offer a ultimate performance flagship at a chosen price point, which is pretty interesting in a way. But again, they've confirmed that it's going to come with a 50 megapixel Sony IMX766 sensor, 50 megapixel primary. Okay, that's the primary, and you have a secondary ultra wide camera with a 119 degree field of view and a macro sensor. That's pretty interesting in a way. And on top of that, obviously, they've shown off the colors of the phone, and it'll come in jade green and moonstone black, which kind of looks like their iconic sandstone black backing, which everyone knows OnePlus 4. It's iconic. It's typical OnePlus to have sandstone back. But as I said, they're probably ditching all the original bits of the OnePlus brand that they've always known, that the whole world has known them for. That's pretty interesting. And if you see in the design generally, it looks like the 10 Pro, but it's a bit scaled back. It's got a glass back in a way. It's curved from the back. and as I said, has a normal kind of display, and has it doesn't mention the fast charging, so I'm probably assuming it's going to be a good, decent fast charging capacity in a way. And on top of that, this phone is going to be coming with the OnePlus 8 Plus, 8 Plus Gen 1. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And this is, as I said, for their mid-year upgrade. Now, it's weird that they did not bring out the OnePlus 10 regular, but as I said, I'm probably assuming that the supply chain crisis that we talked about early on, another sort of circumstances that meant that they didn't bring a regular OnePlus 10. And I'm probably assuming they're trying to offer this as like a normal sub $600-$700 phone to compete for the same kind of people who buy a Pixel or an iPhone. And obviously the Pro is obviously for the pros, obviously. So that's probably self-obvious from the get-go. So again, it's pretty interesting development from the folks over at OnePlus. But yeah, it'll be pretty interesting to see what OnePlus brings to the table here with the 10T, hopefully. It's probably a slightly good step up from the 10 Pro. And again, it's not as compromising or disappointing as say, the 10 Pro has kind of been. And obviously, it's deviated heavily from what OnePlus has been all about. So that's pretty interesting in a way. Along with that, Motorola, interestingly, has announced in China that they're doing a launch event for their Razer Foldable and the X30 Pro phones. And they posted on Sina Weibo that on August 2nd, 7:30 p.m. China time, they're going to be doing a launch event showing off the new X30 Pro and the Razer 2022, which had been long teased and long awaited. And they've teased the Razer phone from the back, and it's pretty interesting in a way. More than everything, according to rumors, this could be the X30 from Motorola could be the first phone to come with a 200 megapixel camera, which is interesting in a way. And again, it would come with the 8 Plus Gen 1 and all that good stuff. The Razer, on the other hand, obviously has been long rumored and long reported that it's going to come with the 8 Gen 1, and obviously with 120Hz display and all other features. And I've talked about it on a previous episode early in there, so you can go back and find it. Obviously, it's will be mentioned with Razer, so you do search for that if you have the time. So it's going to be a decent high-end phone. Obviously, Motorola, Lenovo's answer to the Z Flip 4. The timing is pretty interesting, a whole week before the Z Flip 4. So probably I'm assuming that they're probably going to roll out the new Razer before Samsung brings out its own clamshell foldable. So that's pretty interesting in a way, I guess. It's pretty interesting, I guess. So good on Motorola, probably. We'll see. Again, it's next week, so can't wait for these two phones. All right, we've already talked about phones. Let's move on to watches and the Apple Watch. And Mark Gurman from Bloomberg reported in one of his analysis that Apple's looking to create, according to his sources, Apple's looking to create an Apple Watch Pro. That obviously there'll be a new Apple Watch that'll come with the new iPhones, of course, the Series 8 that'll come out in September in the fall. But also that Apple's planning to create a Pro Apple Watch, which apparently would be evolution of the current rectangular shape in a way. So that's pretty cool nonetheless. And also a couple of things to touch upon. First is the Apple Watch Pro would be made of a more durable titanium frame, which is pretty interesting, to make it rugged from the get-go. So no cases needed or, you know, accessories needed to make it rugged. Again, it'll be an evolution of the current rectangular design. So it won't be rounded. It won't be curved on the sides. It'll probably be quite durable and designed for a certain set of consumers. And speaking of that, the Watch Pro is going to be larger. Apparently, the casing for the Pro will be larger than 45 millimeters, have a 7% bigger screen than the Apple Watch Series 7. So that's roughly 410 by 502 pixels. So that's pretty interesting in a way, basically a larger display in a way. On top of that, it's gonna feature a longer battery life, which is strange. You don't expect that. But also, it can last multiple days on one charge with a new low power mode, according to Gurman. So that's pretty interesting. Obviously, Apple Watches, this battery life is just normal, like 1 or 2 days battery life. It depends on what you do with it and how long you obviously and whether you charge it back up. last couple of days usually, so that's pretty interesting. On top of that, you have a low power mode that'll be added. So again, you can use certain features, and again, it'll extend the battery life to be several days long, along with all of the following, and with a similar chip to what's going to be on the Apple Watch Series 8, which with the S8 chip in a way. You also have the ability to do body temperature measurements, which is never possible. It has not been possible on other smartwatches, except for like pro grade smartwatches or body track, again, fitness trackers, probably like your Polars and your Fossil, no, not Fossil, your your Garmin and Fossil, and there's a very famous like sports athlete oriented fitness tracker called the Polar and the Garmin, and they have a whole bunch of tracking and sensors. They're again designed for pro athletes and obviously for a specific class of individuals who want to track all sorts of metrics with their everything from their health. Again, quite granular details to again would be again great for fitness and health tracking. But yeah, you can do the Apple Watch Pro is expected to offer support for body temperature measurements. Along with that, you'll get an approximation basically. You won't get an exact measurement, of course. On top of that, you expect things like blood pressure monitoring and glucose measurements, which is quite unique. If they could pull this off, I can definitely see a lot of people. I could see the appeal of this watch potentially to a lot of people. But basically, this Apple Watch Pro is intended to be ultra premium, be rugged. It has a unique design. It's bigger, and again, it appeals to those class of consumers. In a way, it's pretty interesting. Obviously, hearing this. Information from Mark himself. It's probably surprising, obviously, but again, not surprising. Apple Watches are very popular. Apple obviously has built a decent market share with the Apple Watch, and there's competition obviously coming on in a way to an extent. And I think also you'd realize that also a lot of people buy smartwatches or fitness trackers wouldn't really necessarily get an Apple Watch. It's not their first choice. They would go for whatever the competition has on the table with better tracking and better functionality and better battery life. So I'm probably suspecting Apple's trying to chase that other end of the fitness tracker wearables market that would are not really casual consumers in a way and would get a watch to essentially measure their heart rate and all, because you already have competing products that are obviously cheaper and obviously do that again. For a better price and with better functionality. So I'm not surprised really that they're going to be chasing a different consumer class, a different set of consumers or a different market with this Pro model. It probably would be most it'd be a typical Apple Pro product with features designed for a certain class of users and intended for them in mind. And in this case, for those who are athletes and again, people who are very conscious of their health. But as I said, it's a pretty interesting it's an interesting rumor from Mark Gurman himself, but again, we'll see for the when the Apple event happens later this year if there's going to be a Pro variant of the Apple Watch. But then again, it's pretty interesting nonetheless. All right, so we're going to move on to Anker, and they have shown off a whole new line of gallium nitrate chargers. Basically, these are chargers that have whose conductors and chips are based on gallium nitrate instead of the regular designs that are obviously that go into chargers generally. Again, this is based on gallium nitride technology, which is pretty cool. And these are upgraded variants. And obviously, Anker has obviously brought regular chargers and obviously power bank slash chargers, obviously, which is pretty cool to have. So first of all, it features a hybrid flyback architecture, which apparently has 95% energy conversion efficiency to reduce energy loss by 21%, up to 21%, by the way. That was pretty cool in a way. On top of that, you have a it takes full advantage of the gallium nitride technology to bring energy loss down by up to 7.2%, which improves efficiency and all, and comes with Anker's latest and greatest Power IQ 4.0, featuring dynamic power distributions. Obviously, that obviously takes into consideration the needs of different devices and pushes power depending on the device in question. So if it's a wearable, it obviously pulls in regular 5 watt, and if it's a MacBook, pulls in full 90 watts, and obviously it keeps it quite efficient and doesn't overload or overcharge or again overpower a device and all. And again, can support over power and is compatible to over 1,000+ devices, according to the according to Anker's website over here, which I've pulled up, mentioning here. On top of that, you have Active Shield 2.0, which does temperature monitoring, and again, it increases that frequency to 76% compared to the first generation Active Shield tech. And again, it monitors temperature up to 3 million times to ensure that devices are being charged. And again, prevents devices from being overheated and obviously blowing up. So that's pretty cool in a way. And apparently, because of the temperature reduction, it allow the charger to last up to 2.4 times longer than the average charger out there. So that would be basically up to 12,500 hours of use, potentially. So that's pretty cool in a way. And because it's a gallium nitrate charger, it's efficient, it's fast, and it's a single charging plug, so you can just plug it in and charge all your devices out of the go. It's more environmentally friendly, because obviously Apple's ditched the chargers in the iPhone, and they say it's environmentally friendly because it would prevent them from carrying extra waste, which is plugs, and obviously the plugs carry more, obviously mean they produce more carbon dioxide. But speaking of that, this is assume every person and household use gallium nitrate chargers from Anker. You could save enough energy to power Hawaii for up to 30 days. That's how efficient these chargers are. So that's pretty cool in a way. And we could reduce e-waste by up to 300,000 tons. This is assuming people run out and buy chargers, but instead they end up buying an Anker GaN Prime charger, is what it's called, the GaN Prime charger. And if assuming every person in the US uses it instead of a regular cheap 10 buck charger from Amazon, they could save e-waste by yearly up to 300,000 tons, which is crazy pretty much. And in return, by replacing silicon with gallium nitride in manufacturing chargers, you reduce CO2 emissions by up to 30%, which is pretty cool in a way. So Anker's gallium nitride prime lineup includes a bunch of chargers, everything from regular wall plugs all the way up to extension wires, and again, they're hybrid power bank charging plugs. So let's touch on a few. So you have the 735, the 737, and the 747 for regular wall plugs, and they're giving you capacities of between 65 to 150 watts theoretical. And again, the base one comes with two USB-C plugs and one USB-A, all the way to three USB-C plugs and one USB port input. So that's pretty output. So that's pretty cool in a way. And then you have the 733 power bank, which is basically a power plug and charger in one. And it's the iconic hybrid sort of. And it has a maximum charging speed of 65 watts, comes with two USB-C ports and one USB-A port, which is pretty interesting. It has a little button so you could see your charging devices are charging, or they're charging at their max capacity in a way. And then there's two unique power strips or cords, you could say, that are charging plugs, and they're pretty cool in a way. First one is the Anker 615 GaN Prime 65 watt power strip. This is pretty cool. It's a thick compact power strip. It has one single plug, so you can plug your laptop charger if it doesn't support USB-C. It has two USB-C plugs and a USB-A plug, which is pretty cool. And charges up to maximum 65 watts. And as I said, fun fact, that the 615, you can put in the wire. You can sort of tuck it in because it has a rubber flap around the body of the strip. So how it works is essentially it has a rubber sort of layering, and you can pull it and essentially wrap up the strip, the wires, so you can make it nice and compact. And again, easy to travel with, so that's pretty cool. But the real one, the really interesting power strip, one can say, is the 100 watt GaN Prime 100 watt 727 from Anker. It has a max charging speed of 100 watts. Comes with two USB-A ports at the bottom, sort of, so they're compact, so you can plug in any device and charge it straight away. And two USB-C plugs along with it, on top of two proper plugs that you get. So again, charging at a maximum 100 watts. So that's pretty cool in a way. And it's cool to see that they obviously are labeling their products with a number so you don't get it confused or you don't get a knockoff, which is pretty scary sometimes. Because obviously Anker products sometimes you might end up getting a knockoff. So it's good to see that they have a number so you can find them. They're already available on Amazon, and obviously the chargers obviously start. Okay, so the power strip that I was talking about, which is compact, obviously, that starts on $70. And then the one I mentioned previously, the fast charging 6-in-1 plug power strip, you could say starts from $95. And then that power bank slash wall plug charger is $100, the 65-watt. And again, the 65-watt regular 735 charger, the GaN Prime one with three ports, kind of two USB-Cs and one USB-A, starts from $60, which is pretty interesting. Again, I'll try my best, I'll link these chargers in the show notes, so you can check them out for yourself. And you can buy them off Amazon, and obviously it has affiliates links, and there are affiliate links in the show notes. So if you buy from there, it'll support the show in a way, so that's pretty cool. If you want to do that, you're definitely welcome to do that in a way. But this is a pretty interesting gallium. Now, gallium nitride as a technology has been used in chargers for the past couple of years. And again, it's cool to see that Anker is bringing a more advanced form of chargers. And again, being very efficient and can, again, deliver power to all your devices when you're charging and all that. And again, it's efficient and, again, stays cool under intense pressure. So it's pretty cool to see this product from Anker. And again, pretty cool chargers nonetheless. All right, so we're going to talk about this interestingly. OneWeb is merging with Eutelsat, as far as I understand it. So if for those who probably don't know, OneWeb is this like competing satellite internet constellation that is taking on SpaceX's Starlink service, which already is up and running, is serving regular customers in rural and remote areas. And people, and as I said, businesses, and especially people who have RV yachts and planes, so much so that Starlink has gotten deals with various airlines to offer high-speed in-flight Wi-Fi. And satellite internet is a big business, especially for certain users, like it's got maritime and aviation uses. So if you have a private jet or your airline, or you probably have yachts or even a big ship, it obviously can be tough to be connected. It'd be difficult to be connected to the internet unless you're on shore or on ground. You'd be connected locally to the internet. But when you're in the sea, when you're at sea or in the sky, it's tough to be connected to the internet. So satellite internet's got a massive use in a way. But yeah, it's a lucrative market. And obviously, if you get to all sorts of companies that want to get high-speed internet, so much so I was reading earlier. That OneWeb did a test where they put a little antenna on an airplane, on a Boeing 777, and they were able to do a Microsoft Teams call, stream 4K YouTube, and play VR and stream VR games, which is crazy. And that tells you, if they're able to pull that off in a test, just imagine for regular users what kind of benefits in terms of speed and access you're getting when switching over to this kind of low Earth orbit satellite internet. Now, we have had regular satellite internet. It's very slow, iconically. It's not usable. It's not viable for certain users and certain applications. It's like if you really need to get online and send an email or something, you gotta have satellite internet. But just generally for you and me kind of internet use cases, like streaming YouTube, multiplayer gaming, video conferencing, it's next to impossible. Forget it. It's very slow, it's laggy, but obviously Starlink has changed the game with its low Earth orbit service. OneWeb is a competitor to this, and now OneWeb is planning to sort of combine with Eutelsat, which is an iconic satellite provider, a pan-European satellite player. It runs a large constellation of broadcast and telecommunication satellites. Those who may not know, if you know the Hotbird satellite, which is a broadcast satellite that is mainly targeted at the Mediterranean and the Middle East and North Africa by extension. It's a very popular satellite for foreign channels, for news channels and all. And that's run by Eutelsat. So it's based in Europe, it's based in the in France. It's kind of a European player in satellite connectivity and broadcast and tele and communication satellites for everything from geostationary for regular satellites to do internet connectivity for certain clients like military and government users, all the way to again direct to home satellite TV. And now they need a new business model, new business stream, of course, to get customers. And people need high speed broadband all over the world, and business is needed, and obviously aviation and maritime users needed a lot. So they need to have a foothold in the low Earth orbit satellite internet business, let's just say, to take on Starlink. And so both OneWeb and Eutelsat have agreed to merge pretty much, and that means that they'll get that this combined entity will have 36 geostationary orbit satellites, those ones that do that handle calling and satellite TV and all, along with OneWeb's massive constellation, which includes 600 total 648 satellites, of which 428 are in orbit. So it's pretty interesting in a way. On top of that, after everything, Eutelsat will own 100% of OneWeb, so that's pretty cool. In return, OneWeb shareholders will own 50% of Eutelsat. So they're merging, and again, it'll be kind of the deal will be done by the end of this year. And again, subject to regulatory and shareholder approval. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And obviously, this combined entity will mean that some of OneWeb's executives will be serving both Eutelsat and OneWeb as a merged entity. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And according to them, why they're merging, they see a potential value, the segment pretty much, which is B2C and B2B internet connectivity, let's just call that, is becoming popular. Apparently, it will reach a combined value of roughly, get this, $16 billion by 2030. And you think of all the customers for that. So regular users, they plop a satellite in the air and they get low Earth orbit broadband internet, on top of, again, people on ships and planes who need internet, on top of, let's just say, corporate users and provider and even telecom provider mobile providers who want a backend link. They want to connect to the internet. It's very remote, but they need to get a 5G signal, but they need a backend. So the satellite, so that low Earth orbit satellite service could come in handy, can come in, you could say, for my Gen Z folks, it can come in clutch to carry, to send internet data from, say, a mobile user. So it has a lot of uses. Okay, that was what I was meant to say, was backend, yes, for backhaul, as they call it in the cellular industry, could come in clutch for internet backhaul to again connect to the wider internet through satellite. It'll be quite reliable and low latency, and it could be a $16 billion market by 2030. I could definitely, it could be worth more, who knows? So that's pretty interesting in a way. And after, obviously, once shareholders and regulators approve of this merger, it'll be both companies will continue to operate in a complementary manner. But down the road, they'll probably combine and have a it will have a common platform and hybrid terminals. So how I'm kind of seeing it is that OneWeb is bringing to the table for Eutelsat that lucrative low Earth orbit broadband constellation, sort of that delivers high speed internet via satellite pretty much, but as a lower altitude compared to regular broadcast satellites. So that's pretty cool in a way. And you can kind of see I'm kind of geeking out about satellites, but it's a pretty interesting merger. Again, it's just to take on Starlink and obviously other competing satellite constellations, sorry. And it probably could, and who knows, maybe telecom providers are like, you know what, let's actually send 1,000 satellites into the sky in low orbit and serve potentially billions of customers. You never know. Telecom providers could be looking to those constellations. Interestingly enough, OneWeb's business model is different from Starlink. They're not going to be doing B2C. It's actually B2B more. So they're catering to corporates, to companies, basically to aviation and maritime companies, or folks having planes and ships, and also telecom providers that want to offer, again, for example, cellular backhaul via satellite. Again, would be more faster and more reliable than whatever is out there in the market right now. And as I said, for providers that want to offer via satellite broadband internet, so that's their business model. But obviously now Eutelsat's coming in clutch here with this merger. they could get a bigger market share, they could get more customers, and again, a lot of legacy clients that want the high-speed internet that OneWeb is bringing to the table. It's an interesting merger. I could say a merger of equals, one can say. OneWeb is bringing that quality low Earth orbit technology to the table here. Eutelsat is an experienced, well-known satellite provider and have a lot of clients and a lot of customers that surely want OneWeb's service. And they already have a lot of clients in airlines and maritime companies that want satellite internet. And obviously, OneWeb is a faster next-gen solution. So again, it'll come in clutch, let's just say that again for all my Gen Z folks. So this is an interesting merger. Obviously, it was reported before, but as I said, it could be an interesting merger. Again, to take on Starlink in a way. More than everything, a couple of interesting tidbits. This combined entity is expected to have EBITDA, that's basically earnings before interest, taxes, deductions, and amortizations, of roughly 700 million euros by 2023. On top of that, an annual revenue synergies of roughly 150 million euros after 4 years. And again, a run rate savings before tax of roughly 80 million euros after 5 years. So that's pretty interesting in a way. So yeah, but yeah, as I said, Eutelsat and OneWeb will be a combined company after this, after approval, of course, and OneWeb will continue to trade with its regular business, obviously in the UK, and obviously this combined venture will also have a secondary listing on the London Stock Exchange on top of the current listing on the Euronext Paris Exchange. So that's pretty interesting in a way. So yeah, it's pretty cool to see that Eutelsat, which is a well-known legacy satellite provider, essentially buying up OneWeb to take on Starlink and other potential constellations that are coming down the road, Amazon and SpaceX, because those two have figured the technology out. They also figured out the business model, and obviously now OneWeb needs to compete with them and need deep pockets and strong experience, decades of experience. And I could see that Eutelsat will come in clutch. Let's just say that. I'm sorry, I'll have to stop saying that after this. So they'll need an experienced partner, so they're getting it with Eutelsat, and again, it will create a pan-European player that will take on, as I've mentioned earlier, Starlink and again other and again Amazon's offerings. So that's pretty cool in a way. Let's see how this pans out. It's gonna be a while. It's gonna take a couple of months before this happens, but it's pretty interesting. But it has immense potential because unlike SpaceX, which is a upstart space launching company, Eutelsat is a satellite player. It's known for that. It's not a startup, so I think this has potential in a way. Who knows? Let's just get this out of the way. So Instagram, again, if you've been living under a rock, pretty much, Instagram has rolled out a UI update, which switches its regular iconic home feed from what we know, obviously, a row of photos and videos, obviously in a feed, and you browse to it and like, and obviously, and you do all the following, to something that is more like TikTok, let's just say that, the For You page to an extent, and obviously shoving reels down into people's throats quite literally in a feed. And obviously, still there's an option to obviously see all the posts that are following, so you could see what people have posted. So that's pretty interesting in a way. And basically, it's full screen and not regular. It's a full screen version. Now, apparently, Instagram pretty much, Adam Mosseri, who heads Instagram at Meta Platforms, has just basically said that it's a test in a way. And obviously, the outrage has been real. There are a lot of people that are kind of going like, you're turning into basically a version of TikTok, which is kind of annoying. One user wrote on Twitter, and I'll read here the response. Stop making, this is from Stefan Etini. Stop making everything reels. You're making everyone from journalists to content creators to CEOs and celebrities agree. It's not an app for everything you're advertising and not of my friends and people I think are cool. It's pretty interesting comment from this user. And a lot of people have come out and obviously have spoken against these changes. Even the Kardashians were probably the most unlikely source of people The Kardashians have come out against it, and as I said, it's quite funny in a way, given that basically, in a nutshell, Instagram's moving to videos, sort of focusing more on reels and videos, which is strange, as I said, given that it's all a photo sharing platform instead of something related to video. Now, obviously, Adam Mosseri, obviously, who heads Instagram's division over at Meta, posted a video then after all the outrage, and also a petition, which has amassed 100, yeah, hopefully by the time I'm probably talking about it, over 150,000 signatures. I signed that petition also, which was basically to make Instagram again, which is important. It's shared by a particular user. I don't remember who it was, but it was just a kind of grievance that it's becoming more heavily focused on being a knockoff of Facebook's knockoff of TikTok, which is what we don't want, honestly, because TikTok's doing its thing, and I use TikTok myself. I post highlights of this podcast on TikTok, and it's pretty good for what it is. It does what it says on the tin comfortably, and I don't think just because TikTok is working well doesn't mean that we gotta have knockoffs of it, that Facebook goes in and creates its own version. It's nonsense. Let TikTok be what it is, that it's a entertaining, fun, short form video destination. And again, Instagram, just stick to what it's good at, pretty much. I'm just assuming that it's probably Gen Z and millennial folks, myself included, and probably a whole lot of other people. That is a grievance that Facebook is really trying to turn this into something else, to really compete with other platforms that, and those other platforms obviously have figured out this to a degree, and that they're trying to sort of copy what works elsewhere. And I think it's annoying, frankly, if you ask me. I don't think Instagram should be chasing something like TikTok, because they're distinctly unique platforms. Honestly, at this point, one can probably go and download Be Real and start using that daily instead of Instagram, because seems like Instagram doesn't appreciate if you're taking photos and posting that on your home feed for your friends and family to see, or for your followers to see. So it's quite annoying. But anyways, Marseille kind of responded to all those rants, kind of, and all those grievances and complaints, with a little video, and haven't watched it really, because I, again, couldn't really bother or get myself to watch it. But in that video, he kind of explained that they're moving mainly more to video, to focus on video and reels generally, but basically pictures will be an integral part of Instagram, which is interesting. It's trying to say, well, we're focusing on short videos pretty much, but that but then again, we're still gonna keep photos around, because that's what Instagram's been always about. You taking photos of your cup of coffee or your cat and putting it up for your friends and followers to see was pretty interesting in a way. But honestly, it is. But as I said, it probably makes sense. The complaints probably make sense for a lot of people. Let's face it. I mean, I don't use Instagram to watch short videos. As I said, TikTok is obviously built for that. YouTube is built for that reason, for short videos primarily. And it's kind of stupid that Facebook is trying to sort of turn Instagram into a sort of a knockoff of, as I said, again, turn it into essentially a knockoff of, and to make it a knockoff of TikTok. So, as I said, it's honestly very annoying, and I mean, you can't do much. But as I said, I'll link the petition in the show notes. You definitely should sign that and make your voice heard. Or obviously, you can obviously put your complaint obviously on other socials, probably on Twitter or Instagram. But yeah, I honestly would say that Instagram should just stick to what it really is good at, and that is to post pictures and obviously post real-time moments and stories, and not be a kind of knockoff of another short form video app. And honestly, also one thing I would say is the reels that you're getting on Instagram, they're not that any good. They're not any better than what you get elsewhere. It's not any better. It's just the same recycled sort of top five travel hacks. Did you know? And insert X and Y and Z bit of information. And basically, they're just little short videos sort of to get people's attention. And kind of, it would probably destroy the what Instagram was really all about, kind of. And that was, again, posting stuff, again, to your followers, or, as I said, at the very least, to your friends or family to see moments, probably, I don't know, your baby's first steps, or again, you having a cup of almond milk latte, you know, because that's basically a thing people do because you're on Instagram. So yeah, I mean, it's quite annoying to see them change it up. But as I said, I've left the petition again in the show notes. Do sign it, and again, make your voice heard, which is again because it's important. And again, it's very annoying to see them change things up all the time. So again, kind of annoying for Instagram to become basically a knockoff of TikTok in a way. Finally, we already touched on the Instagram bit. Let's just talk about VR and the PlayStation VR 2. And yesterday, Sony showed off some new bits and bobs and new features of the PSVR 2. Now, for those obviously don't know and have kind of forgotten about this, PlayStation made a VR headset, of course, called the PSVR, obviously, when the Oculus Rift blew up, of course. And it was for the PS4, and it was kind of popular. People loved it. It was just a fun little accessory for the PlayStation 4. It didn't really take off massively as it was initially hoped. The HTC Vive and the Oculus Rift was more popular by extension. But now, Sony obviously was not really swayed by its failure. They're making a sequel to the PSVR 2, obviously taking in everything they learned from the original PlayStation VR. And obviously built for the PS5 instead of PS4, so that's pretty cool in a way. But today, yesterday, they showed off a bunch of new features of the PSVR 2. First, they showed off a see-through view. So when you're using the PSVR 2 in a particular game or a particular VR app or game, you can sort of press the PlayStation button, and obviously it brings up quick settings. You can click on see-through view. And through the cameras are located on the front of the headset, you can see your surroundings without having to take off your headset, because you're already obviously going through a lot and you put on the headset, so you don't want to take it off and see what's behind you. You don't want to be in a game and suddenly you fall on your head, you trip. So it's cool to see a see-through view. So you just click a button and you essentially see a view, essentially the camera in front of you, the cameras on the headset in front, so you could see what's going on. So that's pretty cool in a way. I don't think there's a VR headset that's done this before. I can see applications for this, of course, if they expand the see-through thing to include AR applications. It could be pretty cool because you can see your surroundings and you can do things with it. That's pretty cool in a way. And we're going to touch on another feature, and that is basically it's a mode that is there when you connect the PS5's HD camera, which has been around with the PS5, but it also will come in clutch for the PSVR 2. And how it works is you connect to the PS5, and obviously if you stream or record yourself playing a VR game, the HD camera that is sold separately, of course, will record your face cam when playing it. It's pretty cool. You don't have to get any external accessories or webcams to capture yourself playing a VR game. So it's kind of built in, and that's pretty cool for sharing your VR moments or jump scares or your, oh my god, that actually looks immersive, not gonna lie. Those kind of moments, you can obviously have that feature, so that's pretty cool in a way. That, again, it's cool to see that PlayStation bringing those features in a way. Another one on top of that mode when you're recording or streaming to Twitch is called Customized Play Area, and basically you can the camera obviously in your headset can detect the surrounding around you already in a way, but now thanks to the Sense controllers and the embedded cameras, you can go in and sort of manually tweak the area, the customizable play area for the headset, so you can play in that surrounding and you're not going to be butting in, which is nice to have. And if you get close to the boundary, you'll get a warning. And again, that's because of the sensors and the cameras on the headset and the controllers, which is pretty cool in a way. And again, you can customize the area, again, to fit your style of play and your room environment. So you could take into account the height and the area of the room or something come in the middle like a sofa or a cabinet. So that's pretty cool in a way. And and this is all on top of the fact that PSVR 2 will have two modes out of the gate. So there's a VR mode, so you can enjoy all your VR games that will be coming to the PS VR2 in 360-degree field of view at a resolution of 4,000 by 2,040. So that's roughly 2,000 by 2,040 for each eye. So combined 4,000 by 2,040. All right, so you have two modes with the PSVR 2. You have the VR mode, as I mentioned earlier, and another one is cinematic mode. So this allows you to sort of use the PS5 regular mode and access the UI, binge Netflix, watch Netflix, access different apps, play your Blu-ray discs if you have any remaining, play regular PS5 games. So it's kind of a regular mode to access the PS5 with the VR headset, so that's pretty cool. And it's displayed in full HD HDR with either 24 or 60 hertz and also a 120 hertz frame rate, so that's pretty cool in a way. Now they didn't mention when this VR headset is going to be coming, but they've again touched upon these extra features that it's nice to have. And it's cool to see that Sony is obviously bringing these little tidbits to the table. The fact that there's like a VR and cinematic mode along with the ability to essentially tweak your sort of area around you when you're using the VR headset, and on top of that, being able to have a see-through view, so you're not going to be tripped in and you're not going to trip and fall because you're in a VR world. You could just click a see-through view and you get it. You get basically the cameras kind of pipping the view of your actual real world. That's pretty cool in a way, and I think that's pretty cool of Sony to offer that feature on the PSVR 2. We don't know when it's going to come out. We don't know how much it's going to cost, but it's going to be expensive, of course, because it's quite advanced. It has a high refresh rate. And Sony is no stranger to selling PS5s at slightly above its MSRP. So don't expect a cheap, how do I say it? Don't expect the PSVR 2 to come cheap. It's going to be a pricey VR headset because it's a pretty cool VR headset in a way. So yeah, again, we don't know when it's going to come out, and we certainly don't know what this what it's going to come with. But again, it's interesting to see what you'll be getting in the box straight away. So again, pretty interesting stuff from Sony.